Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'm going to cut through the noise with interviews, insight, and straight answers from people who make big decisions. Coming up on the program. Private security is under pressure as organized crime turns brazen. Durban's holiday tests, safety, crowds and sewage make things tough this December. The city of Cape Town on the reported Camps Bay beach contamination scare, and from landfill to frontline, how workwear is being recycled for sustainability. It's Wednesday, the 17th of December. Now, Reconciliation Day has delivered another brutal reminder of how bold South Africa's criminal underworld has become. The daylight killing of well-known broadcaster DJ Wadas in Johannesburg comes just days before the burial of Marius van der Merwe, known as Witness D, in the Madlanga Commission. It's a case that has raised serious concerns about witness intimidation and organized crime. And I would suggest these are not just random acts. It seems they point to a sophisticated, well-resourced criminal ecosystem now operating more openly and with apparent renewed confidence. So I want to discuss what this means for public safety, the state of the private security industry in South Africa as well. Is there a link there? And I can think of no better person to talk to than Chad Thomas, organized crime investigator at IRS Forensic Investigations. Chad, a very warm welcome to you. Let's start with the broad canvas, if we can. I mentioned in the introduction, these are not random acts. What's happening here? What is all of this pointing to? What's your assessment?
Look, I'm still in a bit of shock with the news coming out of the assassination of Wadas yesterday. He's not just a well-known media personality, but he'd also moved into the security space, the space we see a lot of people moving into, a lot of people that I think have the right intentions, but also a lot of questionable people moving into the space. We've seen over the years that taxi bosses have bought up security companies through proxies so that they can fight literally turf wars using each other's security companies. It gives access to legitimate weapons. We've seen these same taxi owners hire out their staff as Izinkabi. These vehicles aren't stocked on the road because they are registered to security companies. They're branded, they're marked. People aren't questioned for carrying large caliber firearms and rifles. And we've noted with concern over the few years that a lot of bad actors have infiltrated the industry under the pretext of so-called VIP protection, whereas in actual fact, it's to have one's own personal militia to settle business disputes. And it's far easier to settle a business dispute these days with a bullet or with extortion or in threats than with going through the protected civil process.
Do you think then, Chad, that South Africa's private security sector is properly managed, controlled, and vetted? Or do you think it's becoming increasingly and more dangerously porous?
It's a very interesting question that the very first legislation around security in South Africa came about in 1987 when the Security Officers Board Act was established. That act stayed in place until 2001 and was replaced by the Private Security Industry Regulation Act, which established an organization called CIRA, which is the Private Security Industry Regulatory Authority. They're the statutory body. They're the custodian of the act. And one of the persons that sits on their board is the Deputy Minister of Police. And ultimately, CIRA answers to the Department of Police. So it's a very interesting dynamic that the private sector is in sense managed by components of the South African Police Service, albeit there is no formal relationship. There are a couple of MOUs like BACSA has called E2 and CCIN has, but there's no formalized relationship between the private sector and the public sector, yet they answer to the same minister. It's exceptionally interesting. Another interesting dynamic is that the industry's grown exponentially from the 1990s and in essence replaced policing in suburbia. People with money can afford private security. People that don't have money are the victims of crime because they don't have private security patrolling informal settlements, patrolling different areas in the CBD and in places where there isn't sufficient money to be able to hire protection. And that's sad because the protection of the citizenry of our land is mandated for the state to be responsible for. It's a constitutional requirement, yet we're seeing more and more security being outsourced. We're now sitting at 2.2 million registered security officers, of which between 600,000 and 800,000 are operational. There's tens of thousands of security companies operating. And herein lies a problem. When you've got so many companies vying for the same work, they start undercutting one another. They start using unregistered, untrained individuals, which is a criminal offense. They start taking out competition. We've seen it on the mines in Mpumalanga. We've seen it with the buildings in Heilbrow. We've seen it with the clubs in Cape Town. So the organizations that are meant to be looking after us, that are meant to be taking up the slack where we see issues within the policing, those particular organizations in the private security sector themselves are now being infiltrated by bad actors.
So what I'm hearing you say, Chad, is that we've seen this rapid growth of private security, which is obviously outpacing regulation and oversight, which raises the question about whether the industry can now realistically police itself, or we need far tougher state control, but that doesn't seem to be forthcoming.
CIRA has the money. You must understand that every single security officer in the individual capacity and every single security company has to pay a fee to CIRA to be able to operate lawfully. They have to be trained at a CIRA-regulated training facility or receive recognition of prior learning, and they have to be vetted so that they don't have criminal records. Sam Chauke, who heads up CIRA, is doing the job of trying to ensure that the industry is policed correctly, but it's not happening simply because they haven't invested enough in resources. Now, what's very interesting is that an inspector from CIRA has full peace officer status. That means that they have the same functions as a police officer. So if an inspector from CIRA comes out and inspects and finds something unlawful taking place, he can make an arrest, take the suspects to the local police station, and they can be charged. At the same time, we've seen that CIRA has got their own internal prosecutors who are working to try clean up the industry. There's just not enough of them. And what we're also finding is that CIRA concentrates on the low-hanging fruit. In other words, registered security companies, they know where they're operating from. They may have fallen foul of compliance or governance on one or two issues. They will be raided. But the actual bad actors that are not registered, that are using undocumented immigrants to supply security services, it's difficult to find them. And in some instances, perhaps it's scary to confront them because you're dealing with criminals masquerading as security officers. So CIRA needs to seriously up their game. They're a great organization. They've got the capacity to fund further investigations and inspectors. They now need to capacitate.
And how do they do that? How do they up their game?
They need to increase the number of inspectors 10, 20, 30, 40-fold. They need to show that they are not going to go after low-hanging fruit because there's a lot of distrust from the industry. You'll find that a lot of registered security companies will have a complaint submitted against them by a client or a disgruntled ex-security officer who was disciplined and perhaps felt that he was badly done by, and that company will then be raided. It's good that they're being inspected, but they get raided. But when you see complaints being submitted to CIRA of unregistered security companies operating, it's very rare that you see them actually investigating who the ultimate beneficial owners are. They'll go to car parks, they'll go to nightclubs, they'll raid, they'll find the unregistered security officer standing outside, they'll arrest them, but they won't investigate further as into who's benefiting from placing these unregistered security officers on the beat. And therein lies a massive problem. So CIRA is doing their job. If you follow CIRA on social media, every single day you'll see them post a disruptive and dismantling operation where they've come across unregistered car guards or they've come across unregistered bouncers. But what we are not seeing are the masterminds who are behind this, who are setting up proxies to buy security companies, to find legitimate firearms, and then to undercut legitimate security companies who are paying the correct rate to their security officers and not exploiting them. Because one must always remember, security has a massive human factor. And if you're not looking after that product, if you're not paying that product what they should be getting paid, they are going to become a problem.
And what do we know, Chad, of these masterminds? Who are they?
It seems like everybody's jumped onto the bandwagon. It's unbelievable. Everybody's seen a gap within the security industry. This comes down to our criminal justice system. When you see that SAPS cannot provide a service any longer, when you see the low conviction rates of cases that are enrolled, it means that the security industry grows and the security industry becomes a viable investment for both good actors as well as bad actors. Bad actors because they can use legitimacy of hiding behind a security company to extort on behalf of business forums, the so-called construction mafias, water mafias, etc. And at the same time, you see that the bad actors want access to legitimate weapons so that they can settle their squabbles. They can settle their scores using their militias. There was an incident in Sandton about 2 years ago where two rival security company owners that were vying for security of the clubs, because if you control the door at the club, you control what gets dealt inside that club if that club is dealing drugs. They were vying for control of these. It landed up in a shooting and one of those guys got killed. Later turned out that that particular security company owner was one of the people wanted in the Marubo Peña assassination. So we're now seeing security companies using their people actively in the underworld to conduct hits.
Chad Thomas, thank you very much indeed. A very disturbing situation. Organized crime investor at IRS Forensic Investigations. I do appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, as Durban is gearing up for the festive season, the city is once again positioning itself, and I quote, as ready for the holiday influx. But tourism risk goes far beyond policing numbers. It's also about whether a city can cope when arrivals surge, infrastructure is stretched, and services are under pressure, as well as environmental systems that are always tested, and I guess expectations are high. Well, let's see how the Metro is dealing with all of this. I'm in conversation now with Winelia Mtungwa, who's deputy head of Durban Tourism. Winelia, a very warm welcome to you. Peak season, I think, stress tests everything. Are there parts of Durban's tourism system right now that are most vulnerable when visitor numbers are already starting to increase?
It is indeed peak season, so there could be an anticipated stretch here and there in terms of the influx of visitors. And in relation to the risk, I think over the years, the recent years, 2 or 3 years after the floods where our infrastructure was a bit, you know, destructed, the high risk has really been the issue of the water quality, which would be emanating from the E. coli and then visitors not being able to go because of the infrastructure, you know, challenges. However, because over, you know, the recent period, the teams of infrastructure maintenance have been hard at work, we have been able to get that, you know, above board in terms of the infrastructure maintenance and the beaches not being closed. And recently, only two beaches had challenges, the Umhlanga Beach. But again, in terms of swift mitigation of the risk, that was sorted within a day. And as we speak, the beaches are all, you know, working, because that risk then, you know, trickles to the visitor numbers, because 60% of our visitors that make a decision to come to the destination, they then make the decision based on the beach. So that would have been the high risk. But because of the swift turnaround that the teams have put in place, we are actually, you know, on a better position now in terms of having that sorted out. Water quality is perfect, and the testing of the water quality that happens very regularly, because we are transparent in making sure that, you know, our visitors are aware that, okay, this is what it looks like, and we make sure that we are able to intervene in terms of where the root cause of the challenges are.
What exactly has the city done in terms of poor bacterial levels? How have you addressed that in order to make sure that the beaches do remain open?
It is more around the infrastructure, because in terms of the filtering of the debris, when there's high clog, then the water gets contaminated. So if the infrastructure, there's proper flow and there's not clogging of the debris, then there's actually that proper, you know, water, you know, quality, and less, you know, debris that is clogging and actually going to the beach water. So that has been those mitigations. Because if the infrastructure is not appropriate, then it collects all different debris that then intensifies the concentration level, you know, of the toxicity into the beachfront. So the infrastructure maintenance teams have been hard at work in terms of sifting around to unclog the debris and making sure that the flow of the water in terms of concentration is way less.
The mayor was talking yesterday about as many as 1.3 million visitors. I think that's the target that the city has set itself. One of the problems, of course, is congestion risk. So roads, beaches, promenades, public spaces. How are you doing that without degrading the visitor experience?
Okay, Jeremy, I think when you talk congestion, really, it's very subjective because our city is big. While there could be a concentration of people into one area, like let's take the beachfront, you know, precinct, but we've got like an 8-kilometer promenade, you know, and different beaches in the north. So there's a lot of space for different people to actually be able to go and enjoy themselves in terms of that. And also the other thing, we've got lifeguards and different, you know, law enforcement people that will, you know, direct people to other parts. However, over and above that, in terms of, you know, the clogging, there's the traffic management, both in terms of vehicles and also with people. Because right now, the accessibility into the beachfront, we have closed it to limit cars to actually go there. And we've got designated areas of park and ride where people are able to park their cars in safe areas, like the old driving site and Centrum site parking. And then they actually take, you know, a bus, a park and ride bus to the beachfront, which then limits the traffic flow and congestion thereof. So that has been a smooth flow yesterday when there was a lot of numbers, being the 16th holiday. And again, there's a big plan for that in terms of the 31st as well as the 1st of January. And the other thing is that with our CCTV cameras, that over 500 of them in and around the city, the places where tourists would be anticipated to be congested, we are able to see, and the Metro Police actually go there to actually make ease of that, you know, traffic flow. Could it be people? Could it be the cars themselves? And there hasn't been really any risk of a stampede. Everything is flowing properly in the beachfront. The lifeguards are there. They are vigilant throughout the different parts of the coast of Durban.
Crime is always a problem. Is the tourism office satisfied that enough law enforcement officers have been deployed this festive season?
Absolutely. On the 5th of December, there was a launch of FESMEC, which is the festive season readiness, and the safety and security cluster, Metro Police Commissioner, presented a plan, obviously not too much detail in terms of what the safety plan is. So one of the things that the city has done in terms of, you know, preparedness of the crime, the deployment is intense. There's about 2,000, you know, more police forces, law enforcement that are in around the city. That's number one. Number two, there's a specific tourism, you know, policing unit that has been established by the city, and it's stationed within this tourism precincts, which actually would be enhancing the swift turnaround, you know, vigilance of, you know, the crime patrol and also the tourism precincts, whether Florida Road or Umhlanga. So that's another element in terms of the policing. And then the SAPS working with the Metro Police and the disaster, because again, in terms of, you know, the crime situation, a collaborative effort is required. So that is also an additional, you know, workforce into that. And in terms of places, even in the evening, when like last night in the beachfront and other parts of the city, the patrols of police are actually visible within the precincts of the hotel areas, within the restaurant areas, because people are actually enjoying themselves up until after 12 midnight, obviously within the compliance of their licensing that they've been afforded. So in terms of those elements, as we speak, there hasn't been like any crime, you know, incidents that have been reported to say there's a problem here, problem there, because proactively the policing and safety cluster are there with also the policing unit, satellite offices within these different precincts with swift turnaround of dealing with crime.
Thank you very much indeed. I've been talking to Winile Mthungwa, who is Deputy Head of Durban Tourism. I do appreciate your time today. Thank you.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, we read today that Cape Town's iconic Camps Bay and Atlantic seaboard beaches are again at the center of a growing environmental and public health concern, as new pollution warnings highlight persistent sewage contamination in coastal waters. Environmental groups and civic organizations are claiming millions of liters of untreated or insufficiently treated wastewater is being discharged daily into the ocean, either through aging outfall infrastructure or other means. And that is raising the alarm over water quality, health risks for swimmers and tourists, and potential long-term damage to marine ecosystems. It is a serious concern. I'm in conversation now with the city's mayoral committee member for water and sanitation, Councillor Zahid Badruddin. A very warm welcome to you, Councillor, and thank you very much for joining us. Maybe just let's start off with your assessment. Raw or partially treated sewage, to what extent is it being pumped into the ocean right now? How big a problem is this?
So the city's never kept this issue a secret at all. We operate three marine outfalls, Greenpoint, Camps Bay and Hout Bay, that essentially discharge sewage out into the ocean. And the sewage makes its way through a series of screens at the various marine outfalls. And at this point in time, there is no treatment that those various outfalls receive. But it is work underway at the moment that our officials and consultants are busy with.
Work underway, but as you say, it's not a new problem. You haven't hidden this issue. But why is it taking so long to resolve, Councillor?
Yeah, so essentially I think we should start is in terms of the permit, the licenses, which essentially Action SA has now brought this issue up again, as they do at the same time every year, has essentially blamed the city for not abiding by its parameters in the permits, which I've said is untrue and very misleading. Because essentially we've also said to DFFE that the parameters within the most recent licenses are inconsistent with each other, and we've asked them to review the parameters so that they are in line with essentially the original permits that were granted to us by DWS. And so I make that point because any work that is needing to be done for the future of the marine outfall depends on the outcomes of those engagements with DFFE, where they will indicate to us in terms of what the final volumes will be and what the parameters of the various components of the discharge will be at this time. Because it is still under review, it's not possible for us to design any treatment processes at these marine outfalls. But with that being said, at the same time, Jeremy, the city has been presented with three options. Option one, to pipe the marine outfalls further into the ocean. We've said to the consultants that this is not desirable for us because that doesn't solve the issue. It just makes it go further away and further into marine protected area, which is obviously unacceptable. The second option, which we've been presented with, is to pipe the marine outfalls to existing wastewater treatment works, which also is not feasible for us because we have a mountain in the city of Cape Town and it's not possible to go through that or around that without it being at an exorbitant cost. And so the most practical option which we foresee is potentially introducing decentralized wastewater treatment works at these locations, which, again, as I mentioned, is dependent on the outcomes with the discussions that we are having with DFFE.
It sounds to me as if you really are putting this in central government's hands. Are you confident that this process is moving quick enough?
It can move faster, I will admit that. I know that the previous DFFE minister had appointed a handful of experts to engage with the city of Cape Town in order to inform the decision that he'd have to make regarding our request to review. Those engagements are currently ongoing, where the experts appointed by DFFE are applying their minds to the information that we've shared. Certainly not putting it in the sphere of national government alone. Obviously, our efforts locally are dependent on the instructions that they issue to us in terms of the parameters within the licenses. So we need that feedback in order to determine what the next steps will be in terms of treatment requirements. I will also say that the mayor has really pushed the Directorate of Water and Sanitation to the point where we accept that treatment is necessary, where we accept that this is not something that should be prolonged for much longer. We know that already at early estimates, decentralized plants may cost the city about 12 billion rand. And also to keep in mind further the fact that the marine outfalls only discharge 5% of the wastewater being produced by our city, the 95% already being treated by land-based wastewater treatment works.
Councillor, to what extent is the sewage starting to harm marine life in what should be protected coastal areas?
And so I think this is where the disagreements between the city and external stakeholders finds itself essentially. On a quarterly basis, we provide very transparent feedback to interested stakeholders at what we call the Permit Advisory Forum. And here, our marine biologists and other scientists present their findings to the various stakeholders, which also often include outside scientists. And so our own data is showing, simply by looking at urchins, sea urchins, who we use as indicators for the health of the ocean in terms of their reproduction rate, that the sea urchins are reproducing perfectly in line with acceptable standards, according to our marine biologists, which suggests that the water conditions are perfectly acceptable. In addition to that, our coastal management branch also very regularly and more frequently during the summer season will test our coastal waters, and they're showing us that coastal waters are well within the acceptable range of swimming. So it's incorrect for Action SA to claim that Camps Bay Beach has been closed because of a sewer overflow. Certainly not the case. There was a precautionary notice put up because of a leak into an unused tidal pool, and they've then claimed for the whole beach to be closed, which is not true.
Is that part of the beach now open? Very quick answer, please.
Yes, absolutely. Sign has been removed. Water quality results have come back perfectly good for swimming.
Thank you very much indeed. The Cape Town City's Mayoral Committee Member for Water and Sanitation, Councillor Zahid Badruddin, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
MoneyWeb at midday. For all your up-to-date stories.
South Africa, I read, has a textile waste problem hiding in plain sight. Less than 13% of discarded clothing is ever recycled. Most of it, where does it end up? Well, in landfills, which, as you are well aware, are already under severe strain. So as fast fashion accelerates consumption, the question is whether repair and reuse can realistically shift behavior at scale. Well, Johnson Workwear believes it can, and the company has launched a concept called the Johnson Rethread. It's a program focused on, as I understand it, repairing and repurposing worn garments to extend their life and reduce waste. Let's explore this in a little more detail. Nick Johnson, Chief Executive Officer, a very warm welcome to you. Less than 13% of clothing is recycled. Is it a consumer failure or a system failure, do you think?
Jeremy, hi. You know, I think it's a bit of both. Like most things, it's not just one cause, I don't think. I think that the cheap clothing has been thrust on so many people, and people have begun to learn to have way, way too many clothes at their disposal. And our business is completely the opposite of that, actually. We try our best, and we always have. We've tried to engineer products to last a great deal of time so that people don't need to replace their clothes as often as they would normally. So, you know, we just the opposite of what they call fast fashion, which actually is slightly a misnomer because it's actually really disposable clothing where people buy clothing, they wear it a few times, don't like it, throw it away. Fast fashion actually was a term coined by the very smart man who owns Inditex, which is the owner of Zara, where they bring garments to the market quickly. And that's changed now to big, massive chain groups who just, you know, have cheap clothing where people wear it a few times and throw it away.
So, Nick, your focus then is on longevity, but surely that it could be an own goal against yourselves. It could threaten sales volume in what is essentially a growth-driven business.
Yeah, Jeremy, it's interesting that I'm actually not worried about that at all. We are always doing counterintuitive things within our brand to try and work out what's best for our brand and best for our users. Of course, that could, but I don't think it'll have any impact. I think people will actually trust us more than they already trust us, because we engineer products to last a long time. And if they don't last a long time, we'll repair them for free. And of course, some garments are obviously beyond repair, because they, you know, been used a great deal for a long time. And so what we're going to do with those is we're going to repurpose them, which we already are doing. And we're making pencil cases and school book bags for children out of old garments. And we're donating those because, as you might know, we're the lead sponsor of the Rally to Read, which is an incredible project run by the Reed Foundation. And so we take books to you know, thousands and thousands or hundreds of thousands of children every year in dire circumstances all around rural South Africa. And so if we can give them each a pencil case, it changes their lives, frankly. And, you know, we also have corporate customers where we are going to offer to take their uniforms back after they've been used and repurpose them and then let them distribute them to their charities as pencil cases.
Do you think, Nick, that sustainability, as you're outlining it to me, then is now becoming a competitive advantage?
No doubt about it. It has to be, doesn't it? I mean, you know, it absolutely has to be a competitive advantage. And we are very fortunate because I've always insisted that we make our own product. So we're vertical, which is very unusual in our business. We're completely vertical, where we manufacture, we wholesale, and we retail. And we also engineer the products correctly. So, you know, we have the manufacturing capacity to be able to repair products, which other people might find difficult when you're an importer and you have no manufacturing facilities. It's hard to repair products.
This is a very good idea, but what stops ReThread from becoming just a feel-good side project, Nick, rather than a core business model?
Well, we need to make it easy for our users to bring products back to us, frankly. That's the difficult thing. We insist that the products come back to one of our stores. So we don't mind where someone buys a product from, whether they buy them from our stores or from someone else's store or from online, but they must bring them back to one of our stores so we can assess the product, make it, you know, it's pretty straightforward for the customer. We'll take it back and repair it and then deliver it back to one of our stores and the customer can come and collect it. So I think it is quite easy for the customer to do, but as we move forward, we'll have to reassess it all the time and make sure that it is working. I mean, we really want it to work. I'm not sure about you, but I rather like, you know, if you've got an old shirt that you love, or an old pair of chinos that really fits you well and you feel comfortable in them, and you lose the button or the zip gives up or there's a hole somewhere, you know, I'd much rather have it repaired than get a new pair. I don't know about you, but
listen, Nick, you're preaching to the converted here. I've had to prize old t-shirts out of Mrs. Mags's hands, so I fully Look, understand what you say. I think it's a male thing,
problem.
Though.
yeah. Well, t-shirts are another problem, because t-shirts are sort of not garments that are going to last a long time, so they do look a bit scruffy. But yeah. But you know, I love that. So you know, we want people to start enjoying their product. And look, we have stories. People write to us where they've had garments for 12 years, 14 years. We're so proud of that, and we try and make products that last even longer. So we're going to try and do whatever we can to get people to keep garments longer. And, you know, if it means that we sell a bit less, really, it's not going to not going to hurt us that much. We're not a public company that's got to report our numbers every quarter to the investors or to the banks and things like that. You know, it's my business. And if it means that we're creating a much stronger brand, but we sell a few less products, well, so be it. I think in the long term, we'll sell way more products by being a good corporate citizen and doing good all the time.
So let me end with a policy question, if I can. Do you think government should be pushing repair incentives such as yours the way it may be pushed recycling?
I haven't thought of that, actually. I think government got so many bigger issues every day to deal with. I'm not sure whether it could ever do that. But and I'm not sure that the infrastructure that's available to repair, because most apparel retailers are way, way bigger than our business, and you know, it would be very difficult. And they're all importing, well, not all, but a lot of them are importing products, and they're selling products at very, very low values. So they're not very well engineered, where our products are not at, you know, at those values, and we make them well engineered. So it would be a very difficult thing to do. I think it would be hard to do and hard to enforce.
Interesting conversation. Nick Johnson, thank you very much indeed. Chief Executive Officer, Johnson Workwear, I appreciate your time today. And that is our program for today. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We are here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.